Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Among the many concerns that have surfaced in recent months about a second Donald Trump presidency is something called Project 2025. This is a 900-page or 900-plus-page document published by the Conservative Heritage Foundation that has been described as a playbook for conservative policy should Trump win the election. Many conservatives have expressed excitement about how implementing the recommendations put forth by Project 2025 would not only fundamentally alter both the government and how it operates, but the country itself. Critics on the left have focused so much attention on this document that Donald Trump has tried to distance himself from it. He said he knows nothing about it. But in truth, the document was written by many insiders in the first Trump White House, some of whom are involved in getting him reelected. In fact, Trump's running mate, J.D. Vance, has written the foreword to a book coming out in September, written by the self-proclaimed head of Project 2025, in which Vance praises the ideas espoused in that document. So what exactly is Project 2025? Is it a blueprint for a right-wing reimagining of America? How likely would these ideas be implemented in a new Trump administration? How concerned should you be? Joining us to explore all this is the White House correspondent and political reporter for NPR, Franco Ordonez, who used to work here in Charlotte. Welcome back to the program. Welcome back to our listeners.
It's great to be here, Mike.
And John White is also with us. He is a professor of politics at the Catholic University of America in Washington, an expert on the presidency, American political parties, and public opinion, and the author of a new book called Grand Old Unraveling, The Republican Party, Donald Trump, and the Rise of Authoritarianism. Thank you for joining us as well. Good morning.
Thank you so much.
So, Franco, let me start with you, with the basics. The goals of Project 2025 are laid out in this 900-plus page book. It's called Mandate for Leadership, The Conservative Promise. So exactly what is Project 2025, and how long has the Conservative Heritage Foundation been working on it?
They've been working on it for quite a while. I mean, even before Trump was the nominee, as you kind of pointed out, it's a 900-page kind of book that kind of lays out a policy plan. And the idea is essentially to overhaul the American government, going step by step. It really goes into detail, agency by agency, how to kind of gut the civil service and really transform, as they say, the administrative state, all these federal workers, and kind of turn them into more, be able to kind of fire them, essentially, kind of change how they're positioned and allow them to be replaced by loyalists. This is kind of the key point of one of Trump's campaign efforts that he's talked about since even his first campaign, which is getting rid of the deep state, demolishing the deep state. And this is a key part of that. But in that 900-page document, you can imagine there is a bunch of other stuff. There is mass deportations, outlining how to do mass deportations, changing the Department of Justice, making it more political. What it really does, it's kind of a grab bag of choices for a conservative government. And what it does is it kind of takes Trump's policies, kind of his wish list of goals, and puts kind of a legal process, a legal menu, a legal recipe of how to get there.
There were a lot of complaints about the chaos, particularly in the early years of the first Trump administration. And some say that saved us from perhaps going where this document would take us. But this document was formulated in part because this lays out how to do it from day one. John, think tanks, and the Heritage Foundation is one, they produce all sorts of publications. That's their whole reason for being. And they issue public opinions and think pieces on various aspects of American life and policy and government. Has there ever been anything quite like this? Is this different in some way? And if so, how?
Yeah, it's very different. First, the Heritage Foundation has been around for a very, very long time. And the title Mandate for Leadership actually dates back to the 1979-1980 years before Reagan took the presidency. That document was really focused on personnel. Who were conservatives that Reagan could appoint into the government? It didn't really deal with policy per se, but dealt with personnel matters. This, of course, does deal with policy. It's almost exclusively dealing with policy issues. And that represents, I think, a real change. Both for Heritage, but also it is, as has been said, a very much a reaction to the Trump first term, when Trump didn't expect to be elected, didn't anticipate that he would actually become president. He didn't anticipate it, nor did his campaign anticipate it. So they were just as surprised on election night as everybody else was. But they learned lessons from the first term. And those lessons are very much embedded in this document.
Franco, the Supreme Court nominees that Donald Trump put on the bench were, I think, on the list provided by the Heritage Foundation, the three Supreme Court nominees. So is it likely that what's laid out in this proposal would be implemented by a second Trump administration, despite the fact that Donald Trump is trying to distance himself from this document?
Yeah, I mean, I'll tell you that the campaign has worked very, very hard to distance itself from Project 2025. Trump himself, Chris LaCivita, the senior Trump advisor of the campaign, has sought to distance themselves, even calling them a pain in the blank. They've worked very hard. And I'll be clear, this is not Trump's plan, but the way I put it, this is a plan for Trump. And all the authors, or not all the authors, but many of the authors of this 900-page document, and the people who are advising those, advising Project 2025, are very interwoven into Trump world. Many, many of them are former Trump officials, and some of the most loyal Trump officials. Take, for example, Russ Vought. He was the former head of the Office of Management and Budget, a key loyalist to Donald Trump, to the former president. And he also was, part of the platform committee at the Republican National Convention. He's just one example. There are many others, John McEntee, personal. So there is absolutely a lot of interwoven in this, and it's so tightly connected. And as John was saying, these are also personnel matters. He's going to need these individuals to fill a second administration because he's going to want more people to execute the ideas that he have, and that's what this group is saying that they'll be able to do.
John White, the Heritage Foundation has been considered a longtime conservative think tank. Many of the ideas, obviously, that they produce are from the conservative school of thought. But the people on the left have described Project 2025 as something coming from extreme right-wing conservatives. Donald Trump has been described as not being a conservative at all, and some people have said that today's Republican Party is not really conservative, it's the Trump Party. Is the Heritage Foundation, now that they've come out with this roadmap for the Trump administration, are they conservative, really?
Well, that's a good question, because what does it mean to be a conservative in 2024? I think that for Donald Trump and for the Republican Party, it's to follow Trump's lead wherever that goes. I do think there is this hostility that Trump has as a result of his presidency and post-presidency, this hostility that he has to the deep state and the resentment of elites, which is shared by most of his ardent, certainly his ardent supporters. When he says they're not coming after me, they're coming after you. This is aiming, if you will, at the so-called deep state, the intelligence agencies, the FBI, etc. He sees himself as kind of a martyr for a failed government in a lot of ways, and certainly his supporters see government as failing. But the broader electorate doesn't really have a gripe with the broader civil service, per se. Excuse me. I mean, we like Social Security. We like Medicare. We need civil servants to do those kinds of jobs. We want clean air, clean water. We need civil servants to help us achieve those goals.
And the reason you're bringing that, and we like the National Weather Service because we like to know if it's going to rain. And the reason you're bringing those things up is that all of these are proposed to go by the wayside in some form or fashion should this Project 2025 be put into place. On the website, John, for Project 2025, it reads, "It is not enough for conservatives to win elections if we are going to rescue the country from the grip of the radical left. We need both a governing agenda and the right people in place ready to carry this agenda out on day one of the next conservative administration." That's a quote. Are most conservatives, are most Republicans in sync with that belief?
Yes, I think they are. They see this election as existential. They are not simply worried about losing a particular contest and coming back to perhaps regain a win in the future. They see the future of the country as inevitably heading in a direction away from them. And I think that's particularly true when you look at the demography of the country, the rising of millennials and Gen Z in the electorate, the diminishment of the baby boomers and all the rest. So I do think they see this as an existential election, and so do Democrats, by the way. I mean,
I
there's
was
no
just going to
difference.
say. And one of the
That
reasons the Democrats say this is an existential election is because of Project 2025.
That's right. And again, I think the movement of heritage, heritage was a one time, particularly in the 70s and early 80s, a really serious policy-oriented organization. They really transformed into an advocacy organization. And so a lot more attention to the grassroots and the so-called patriots and the rest. And this is all part of that. It's not just designed for policy differences, it's designed to mobilize an electorate already attracted to Trump that says, yes, we want to blow things up.
Franco, the Republican Party is the party that caught the dog when it comes to the abortion issue. They got their way after years of fighting for it, and then they suddenly discovered that the majority of Americans disagreed with the Supreme Court's decision, and now they've been backpedaling on their position a little bit. Project 2025 calls for even more draconian policies with regard to birth control and other aspects of sexual activity, and many other activities involving the government. Is that why Donald Trump is distancing himself? Because he knows it's not popular, or is he really ignorant of what's in this document?
That is definitely one of the reasons why former President Trump is backing away from Project 2025. He knows kind of how polarizing some of these issues in the document are, especially the restrictions on abortion and how they are laid out in the 900-page book. Former President Trump has made no secret that he is very concerned about the abortion issue electorally, and I think you're going to continue to see that kind of play out and debate happen.
We're going to talk more about exactly what is in Project 2025 when we come back. It's been described as both dystopian and authoritarian. Is that accurate, or is that just in the mind or the eye of the beholder? We're coming right back. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. We're here with Franco Ordonez, the White House correspondent and political reporter for NPR, and Dr. John White, professor of politics at the Catholic University of America and author of many books, including The Grand Old Unraveling, The Republican Party, Donald Trump, and the Rise of Authoritarianism. have an email here, Franco, from one of our listeners, Chip, who said he read an article in The New Yorker and learned a lot. He says it's very scary what we're talking about, Project 2025, a very scary remake of our U.S. governing institutions and traditions by a very scary group who have long planned this assault. His words, yikes, is how he concludes that email. This has been described as dystopian and authoritarian, this document, Project 2025. Would an objective evaluation of it bear that out?
You know, Mike, I am not going to go that far and put those kind of adjectives to this document, to this plan. I mean, I think the authors know that, you know, this is not going to be, you know, moved straight from their hands into Trump and implemented into an agenda. They want to put a basket and a wish list of ideas for Trump to choose from. That said, he is likely to choose from some of these issues because these are, they lay out, as I said earlier, kind of a way, a legal way to get some of the goals that he have done. And as you were pointing out earlier, you know, one thing that happened in the first administration is they hit so many guardrails. There were so many people in the administration who, you know, prevented them or told them, hey, that's not legal. This is not legal. You can't do that. You can't do this. I actually spoke with Russ Vaught when I first wrote about this issue. And the way he put it is like, you put in, you know, make these changes. You change the rules so that you can replace these civil service workers. You're going to get people who will do the work that you're seeking. They're going to try harder to implement what they want to implement. And after 4 years, they have a lot more experience fighting the courts, fighting, you know, the administrative state. They know how to do this. Just take the travel ban, for example, against Muslim majority countries. They took that to the Supreme Court several times, or two or three times. Eventually, they got it done. They got it through. They found the way. They have some experience. In order to do some of these things that your listener is concerned about, they do have the experience to put some of those things in operation.
I suppose this is like a negotiation. In a negotiation, the opening salvo is you come to the table and you ask for everything that you want, and you know you're not going to get it all, but you might as well put it all in the opening shot. And this is kind of the opening shot. It's asking for completely changing the nature of the civil service, putting in partisan people to do what the bidding of whoever the president happens to be. It would slash regulations. It would ditch climate change efforts, add additional requirements on abortion nationally, restrict contraception, outlaw pornography, among other things, lots of other things. So, John, would a President Trump be more likely than any other Republican president to push these proposals through?
Yes. That's the short answer, I think, is absolutely yes, because what they've done in this 900-page document is to essentially put meat on the bones of Trumpism. And whatever happens with Donald Trump this year, I think Trumpism is going to be with us for some time. What's so extraordinary about it, because you mentioned some parts of it are deeply, deeply unpopular with the broader electorate, not with the base of the Republican Party, is that they put it in writing. I noted that Vice President Harris the other day made the comment, can you believe that they put this in writing? And we don't have a lot of polling on Project 2025, but what I have seen so far is a greater public awareness of it, and the Democrats, I think, seizing the opportunity to define it, to present its message to the public. And that is a very potent political weapon for them.
A lot of the things that are in this, Franco, are old tropes that we've heard many times before, using old language that we've used many times before, and words that seem innocent on the surface, like the word family. Who can argue with that? And one of the things this argues, a key thrust of Project 2025, is the restoration of the family as the centerpiece of American life. It points to a breakdown of the American family. They call it an institution in crisis. It claims that 40% of all children are born to unmarried mothers, including more than 70% of black children. Do we know if those figures are even close to being accurate?
Yeah, I mean, I haven't been able to go through the 900 pages and fact checked all those kind of details. You know, I'm sure, like many things, you know, things, you know, choices are made based on what serves their interests. But it's those kind of examples and those kind of concerns that, you know, kind of drive energy on the other side that scare other people is why Trump is kind of backing away from so many of those issues. They are so polarizing. He is so focused on winning the campaign that he knows that he has to treat this with, you know, very delicately, very sensitively. I mean, that is why Project 2025 was not mentioned in the Republican platform at the Republican National Convention. He did not speak about it. He didn't speak about abortion at all, for example. And it's because of, you know, how it is outlined in documents like Project 2025, how it has been talked about in the past. He knows the danger of talking about these issues, especially today when he's trying to, you know, kind of fit the need and try to get to more moderate voters, especially suburban women.
So should that worry us? Are they distancing? They're clearly walking away from this, but with the plan, we'll do this if we get in. Should we be afraid of that?
I mean, I don't know that you need to. I don't know if I think listeners I think it's absolutely fair game to point out what is in this document. What are the issues? The people involved, as I've said, are very interwoven with Trump world and the Trump, likely a second Trump administration. That said, is it going to be, you know, is it going to be exactly, is this the recipe that they will use? I'm sure they will use parts of it, but there still is, you know, institutions in the United States that are still very strong that still will, you know, do their job. There will be some guardrails. It's not like the first administration wiped away all the guardrails of the United States. They still exist. They still are. And I can tell you also, Mike, there are agencies, there are legal groups, places like the ACLU that are also arming themselves and preparing for a potential second Trump administration, that they will be ready for these kind of things. They've told me they are studying Project 2025. They know what's potentially coming and they are ready to respond.
The word family means a lot of things to a lot of different people, and it may mean different things to conservatives than to liberals. I'm not sure here, but this document stresses the importance of working fathers as fixtures in the family without mentioning working mothers, and it suggests a tax code. The tax code should be adjusted to remove any disincentives there may be to starting families. I didn't know there were any. I know that there's a child tax credit for people who have children. But given what J.D. Vance has already said about childless politicians and bureaucrats and cat ladies and things like that, is this really more about ending or curbing single parenthood, John White?
Yeah, I think so. But I guess I would answer this in a somewhat broader way, which is that this document really stems from one overriding emotion, and that's fear. It's fear because the nature of family has changed dramatically in the country. We're not talking about a 1950s version of family that's mom, dad, kids. Families come in all forms today. It's fear that we're becoming a less religious society. That's actually mistaken. I mean, there's overwhelming belief in God, but there certainly is distrust of religious institutions. So when you look at millennials and particularly Gen Z, when they're asked about their religious affiliation, the number one answer is none, N-O-N-E. So I think that a lot of this comes from a belief that, again, this election is existential and wanting to restore what they see as an idealized version of America. So make America great again, some way harkens at least the devoted followers of Trump and that alienated working class base back to a period where understandings were clear about family and the importance of religion and so on and so forth. And conservatives, for a long time, have had this enormous fear that they are losing the culture wars. That Christianity is on its way out. That the nature of family is changing so rapidly. And in a lot of ways, this is sort of a document that strikes back at that notion that we need to win elections so that we actually can do what we say we want to do.
I mean, it's a lot of this seems very idealized, very Norman Rockwell to me, and they even mention Thanksgiving dinners as being the centerpiece of family happiness, things like that. And I know that a lot of people will point to Thanksgiving dinner with dread because they have to be around their families. But there are also a lot of contradictions, it seems to me, in this document. One of them talks about restoring the control of parents over their families. But in the next breath, the document asserts allowing parents or physicians to reassign the sex of a minor is child abuse and must end. What happened to parental control, John?
Well, that's a very good question, and that is certainly the theme that that I expect Vice President Harris and the Democrats to pick up on, which is this notion of freedom. They are really seizing that mantle that parents need to have the freedom and authority to decide what their kids are going to take out of the library and not government itself doing it. A freedom to decide on reproductive questions, particularly when health care is a concern. The freedom had always been a Republican issue. It had always been, if we think about the country as united around three principles, it's basically sort of individual rights, freedom, and equality of opportunity. Democrats have always picked up the mantle of equality of opportunity. Republicans had really focused on freedom and individual rights. And what this document does is give Democrats an opening to say, your freedoms are at risk here. And that provides again this enormous vulnerability I think that Republicans have and a departure from the traditional Republican message on this issue.
Franco, as I understand it, Project 2025, among other things, calls for the dismantling of the administrative state, which we've talked a little bit about, and the return of self-governance to the American people. What exactly are they talking about there? I
Yeah,
thought
I
we
mean
were
that's
self-governed.
it goes back to kind of long standing principles of trying to shrink the government, getting the government less involved in everyday Americans' lives. Particularly, this is an issue that resonates with so many of Trump's base of the working class Americans who he is trying to reach around the country. It's a message of trying to get Washington out of their lives, allowing them to make decisions for themselves, moving more power to state and local governments, and less have less of the perhaps Washington kind of being a puppeteer of what is going on. And it's something that resonates with this group, with these supporters. I mean, they very much are they definitely do not necessarily like what they are seeing in Washington. They see kind of a beltway speak. You guys were talking about some of the issues involved, taking transgender issues. They see that coming from big cities like DC, like New York. They see the abortion issue. They see, elites is their word, making decisions for them and not allowing them to make decisions for themselves.
I may misunderstand all of this, John White, but on the one hand, Project 2025 complains about current government practices that go against the Constitution, because the Constitution established Congress as the body that enacts all federal laws and which establishes the Constitution establishes Congress as the most powerful branch of government. And yet, it advocates for the strengthening of the executive branch. and giving them the ability to handcuff, those words are theirs, handcuff the bureaucracy and concentrate the power in the presidency over the operations of federal agencies and civil service employees. And yet, again, can you have both the power being belonging to the Congress and to the executive branch? Those don't seem to be in sync to me, are they?
They're not in sync. And what's interesting, I think, particularly when you look at the Supreme Court majority decision on immunity, they cited Alexander Hamilton's statement in the Federalist Papers that energy in the executive is the leading character of good government, that we want energetic presidents, and Hamilton used that as a standard. And when they decided, by the way, on the immunity question, their reasoning was we need to give the president at least some immunity so that he can do things under the umbrella of official acts. And it is a huge contradiction. There's no question about it. It raises, I think, also a larger point, which goes back actually to studies done in the 1950s and 60s. Public opinion studies that found that Americans are ideological conservatives. They think government is too big, it does too much, it taxes too much. But they're programmatic liberals. If my child has a toy that has lead paint in it, what's government going to do about that? If our air is thick with smoke from forest fires, this is beyond the state's ability, what's government going to do about it? If my water is unsafe to drink, what's government going to do about it? And so I think that distinction is still very much there. But in a lot of ways, when we talk about states' rights and so forth with this document, it's the Republicans that are today's Dixiecrats.
When we come back, I want to talk about authoritarianism, because there are things about this document that some on the left say point to the authoritarian tendencies of Donald Trump and the Republican Party, and you have written the book on it, John White. You wrote two books about it, What Happened to the Republican Party, and the other one is the new one that's just coming out, The Grand Old Unraveling, The Republican Party, Donald Trump, and the Rise of Authoritarianism, and we'll talk about what this change in how the civil service would be handled by the president and what that would do toward those tendencies. It's Charlotte Talks. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about Project 2025, what it may mean, what it's all about, with Franco Ordonez, who is the White House correspondent for NPR. Dr. John White is also with us, professor of politics at the Catholic University of America. Walter, one of our listeners, says that one of our guests mentioned fear, and I think that was you, John White. He says, I think it's important to mention a quote from Trump recorded by Bob Woodward in a 2016 interview he conducted. Trump said, real power is, I hate to use the word, fear. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people are fearful about Project 2025. It proposes a Schedule F plan to reclassify tens of thousands of civil servants as political appointees. Liberals say that enacting these recommendations would essentially weaponize the civil service, with the president filling key positions with loyalists who would then do his bidding, and it would give him the right to fire anybody who stands in his or her way. Is that, in fact, what this would do if it was implemented?
Yes, it would, in fact, give the president,
Would it be legal?
Well, we can argue about that in the courts, right? And that's what Franco was referring to with these other organizations preparing for a legal fight. But I don't think it's wrong to say that the guardrails of our democracy were weakened by Trump, and have been weakened since, that we have to be concerned about that. I don't think that we can no longer say, as we did in 2016, the old expression, well, take Trump seriously, but not literally. I think we have to take him both seriously and literally, particularly when the president calls for, President Trump calls for the suspension of the Constitution, for example. We've never had presidential candidate or a president talk in that way. And I think sometimes the problem that Democrats have when he does this is voters say, well, there he goes again. You know, he's not really being serious here and so forth. But I think we have to take him seriously.
One of the things that Trump complains vociferously about is the weaponization of the Justice Department, allegedly by the Biden administration against him. There's not a single scintilla of evidence to say that any of that is true, but this document would allow the president to weaponize the Justice Department and go after the president's enemies, which is a cause for concern. But it also deals with something that has become a kind of Republican whipping boy at almost every level of government. And North Carolina is a great example of this, and that is public education. This document calls for the elimination of the Department of Education, something that Vice President Harris has already pointed out on the campaign trail as a danger. Franco, why would it be a danger? Why do we need, what function does a national Department of Education play in the education of our children?
Yeah, I mean, one of the concerns that, you know, that Trump and Trump's team is continuing to raise is, you know, again, you know, getting Washington out of the lives of, you know, local people, local governments. And I think this is something that, you know, they've talked about a lot, that they don't, that the Washington government doesn't need to be involved with decisions like this. It goes back to also some of the decisions that we were talking about earlier about transgender bathrooms. Obviously, that is an issue that came up in North Carolina, and not wanting federal agencies to be those involved. And it's not just the Department of Education that Project 2025 has talked about slashing and cutting and ending. You mentioned Department of Justice, and Trump has been very clear about wanting to weaponize the Department of Justice to go after his own political foes. I mean, he has been very clear that he will use the Department of Justice to go after his political enemies. He has been saying that since the beginning of his campaign, and that is something that his supporters very much are looking, you know, favor.
I think it's fairly clear, and this was pointed out to me by a former superintendent of education here in Charlotte, that an organization called ALEC has been working very hard to eliminate public education or weaken public education. And we watch this happen slowly over time here in North Carolina. One of the things that the legislature here has done recently is opened up their Opportunity Scholarship Program to everybody, which means that anybody in the state can get a stipend to attend the private school of their choice. This is something that the Project 2025 advocates on a national level. They want a voucher-like option for parents to use to send their children to private school. It would zero out federal funding for low-income schools and cut what they described as wasteful school meal programs. Is this a plan to end, weaken, damage perpetually public education to punish poor children for being poor? Is that what this is, Franco?
I mean, Mike, you love to ask the toughest of questions. I mean, this is definitely something that is very serious. I mean, this is something that, as you point out, has really grabbed a lot of people's attention in states like North Carolina and across the country. I think there are very valid concerns about how this could weaken education and weaken opportunities for poor Americans and poor young people and, you know, hurt or at least have a very significant impact on the quality of their education.
It also calls for the deprioritization of the fight against climate change, the further unleashing of oil and natural gas production, rolling back environmental regulations and clean energy subsidies. There was an article in the New York Times this morning about food and how what we're going to see in the grocery store in the next several years is going to be very different from what we've become accustomed to because of climate change. We have all these climate change deniers here. It's going to hit. It's already hitting our pocketbooks. Is this what America wants, a rollback of all these things, or is it just what conservatives want? And if that's the case, why do they want it, John?
Well, yes, I think conservatives do want that because they see this as just one more extension of big government. By the way, it's not something that millennials or Gen Zers want, or Zoomers, as we like to call them, want. They are going to be living on this planet longer than I am. I'll just speak for myself. So I do think that that's something that's for them is a priority issue, an almost existential issue. Could I just go back to that education point you were making for a minute?
Sure.
You know, it's interesting that the major federal involvement in education goes back to the Eisenhower administration and Dwight Eisenhower, because after the Soviet Union put the satellite Sputnik up into space, and we didn't have anything to counter that at the time, Congress and the Eisenhower and President Eisenhower supported legislation called the National Defense Education Act. It was a major expansion of the role of the federal government that saw education as both a national security priority and later an economic priority. You asked about the attack on low-income folks. I think that for the authors of Project 2025 and Trump supporters, they see these benefits being provided in low-income schools as people getting something for nothing. And I think that's a prevalent belief there. And it speaks to that.
It also signals a shift away, a shift in opinion and policy among Republicans, because climate change and energy savings and many of the things that they are against today, they were put forward by Republican presidents in the past, from Nixon to Reagan to Dwight Eisenhower that you mentioned a moment ago. I want to get back to the religious aspects of what's in Project 2025. It puts forth what some view as a hard right religious agenda. It would result in revoking FDA approval of mifepristone, the morning after pill. It would allow the use of the Comstock Act. It's an old 19th century act, I believe, to prosecute people who send abortion pills through the mail. It would require states to report where women seeking abortions live. It would end subsidies for stem cell and fetal cell research. Some see this as an attack on science, others as an enshrinement of conservative religious thought into civic life. Which is it, John White?
So I think all of this is wanting to throw the country back into some kind of, again, their idealized version of the 1950s or 60s. You know, abortion wasn't a political issue. There was a large consensus that this was wrong and it was banned and so on and so forth. And of course, the Supreme Court changed that with Roe v. Wade. And the Comstock Act, again, going back to the 1800s, the abortion law in Arizona that was enacted, I think, in the 1840s, at least on the books for a little while after the Supreme Court ruled in the Dobbs case. So you see this party that in some ways is looking backward to this kind of idealized time, backward to a time when we didn't have a civil service. And everything was, of course, patronage jobs, which one president was assassinated over, which is why we have a civil service.
This document, Franco, focuses on the elimination of terms like sexual orientation and gender identity, diversity, equity, and inclusion, gender equality, gender equity, reproductive health, reproductive rights, abortion, all those words they want gone from the vocabulary. What signal is that sending about what this country would be like should they succeed?
I mean, I think what they're trying to do is kind of, as John has been kind of drawing out, is kind of taking it back to a time where, you know, Trump's supporters felt like the country was in a better place, where family was at the center, where religion was a major part of everyone's lives, where they did not have to think about gender issues like the ones that you're raising. I think, these are very serious issues that are being discussed, but in for Trump and for his campaign, I think they're trying to make it very simple and trying to focus on issues that will get them elected in November. Now, Project 2025 is trying to make very specific policy recommendations, kind of outlining the way that they're doing. But I think one of the reasons why Trump is pulling away from it is because of the concerns essentially that you're raising in how it's kind of outlined. Those kind of outlines really raise a lot of concerns with a lot of Americans, particularly, you know, moderate and independents, which is why I think Trump is trying to run away from this so fast.
They also want to outlaw pornography and put the purveyors of pornography in jail. But of course, that takes us back to the old question, how do you identify what pornography is and what it isn't? But we'll move on from that because I'm not sure people want to talk about that. The document is also very critical of Russia and China. It talks about satellite maps of the Korean Peninsula in which the free market South is lit up while North Korea is almost completely dark, except for a small dot in the capital city of Pyongyang, which is where they say, quote, a psychotic dictator and his cronies live. It's critical of communism, of Marxism, of progressivism, of fascism. And yet Donald Trump has embraced the leaders of China and Russia and North Korea. He speaks in fascistic tones. Are they in sync with Donald Trump, Franco?
You know, I mean, I would argue that in many ways the authors are in sync. But in this area, certainly they are playing on, roles against that kind of resonate not only with many in the American public. Of course, they're going to say that they're against authoritarianism. Of course, they're going to say that they're against Marxism. But Marxism, those things in Trump's language are the Democrats. They're the ones, for them, the Democrats are the ones who are bringing in communism. For them, the Democrats are the ones who are authoritarian. For them, it's the Democrats who are weaponizing the government against Republicans. We've heard over and over and over again Trump say, they are not coming after me. They're coming after you. I am just standing in the way. So they do have this kind of Trump has this kind of technique of kind of a, you know, democracy jujitsu, where he's able to kind of flip the picture and kind of paint himself as the victim of this kind of democracy war and kind of use himself as the one who's fighting for democracy.
I have less than 2 minutes left. John, Trump has said he would be a dictator on day one, but only on day one, although most dictators don't give up the power once they have it. He has exhibited authoritarian tendencies. He praises the world's strong men. Would Project 2025, with the help of a Republican-controlled Congress and a conservative Supreme Court that has already kind of made the president a king in that he's immune from prosecution on all official acts, and you go ahead and define what that is, would that essentially cement Trump and any other presidential candidate as the king of America?
Yes, it would, particularly if he wins. Trumpism is not going away if he does lose. But I think he has achieved something quite remarkable within the Republican Party, which is a complete what was initially a hostile takeover of the party. And what is fascinating compared to other strong presidents, if you think of Ronald Reagan or Franklin Roosevelt, just take those two examples, they had factions within their own party that were significant and powerful and tempered them. Trump doesn't have that.
I was going to ask who benefits from this and who would be most hurt by this and how you make a decision about who's right in this and who's wrong. And I guess the answer to that question is to simply listen to NPR, get all the facts, and decide for yourself. Franco Ordonez from NPR, John White from the Catholic University of America. Thank you both for the hour.
Celebrating 25 years on the air, Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Wendy Herkey. The senior producers are Gabe Altieri and Sarah D'Elia. Our engineer is Joby Sprinkle. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or subscribe to the podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.